On Tech News Today, Anonymous takes on the terrorists. Plus, both the latest luxury smartwatch and the next version of Google Glass will have no screens. And we'll tell you how to turn your TV into a Chrome OS PC for $85. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, November 17th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping in time for the holidays when you go to ring.com/TNT. And by BullenBranch.com, the most comfortable sheets on the planet. If you order right now, they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets, plus free shipping. Just go to BullenBranch.com and use the offer code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Our co-anchor today is the Register reporter, Ian Thompson. Hey, Ian, how you doing today?
Oh, pretty good, Mike. And yourself?
Great. I'm doing really, really good. We had some Skype-y issues, both with your connection and other connections. So everybody cross your fingers. And let's hope that this thing actually happens. Ian, why don't we jump directly into our top story? People who are claiming to represent the hacktivist collective Anonymous say they've identified more than 100,000 Twitter accounts associated with the terrorist group Daesh, also known as ISIS, and that more than 6,000 of the accounts have been taken down by Twitter. The action against the terrorist group is being promoted on Twitter using the OpParis hashtag. Anonymous group members have also set up a database of known Daesh-related websites to crowdsource the identification of new Twitter accounts as they go up. And Daesh famously recruits heavily on Twitter, so this may actually have some kind of effect. Jared Keller is the deputy editor for Maxim and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Jared.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Now, before we proceed, I just want to say a little bit about why I say Daesh instead of ISIS. I read an article over the weekend that made the case very persuasively that we should all say Daesh instead of ISIS. ISIS means the Islamic State, or the IS in ISIS means the Islamic State, which is a claim being made by this terrorist group that they are, in fact, the new caliphate, that they are actually a legitimate country, which they are not. They're a terrorist group. And so to refer to them as the Islamic State is to kind of feed into their propaganda that they are this legitimate a governmental organization instead of a terrorist group that's just going out slaughtering innocent people. Daesh is actually the actual acronym for the official name of the group in its Arabic name. So that's all it is. It's just an acronym. However, deliciously, it has the double meaning. It also means in Arabic to trample down or crush, and it also means a bigot who imposes his view on others. So when they created the name of their group, they didn't consider that the acronym was, in fact, an accurate insult for the group itself, kind of like when President Nixon named his committee the Committee to Reelect the President, after which everybody called it CREEP. So they blew it. They named their group that leads to the acronym Daesh. They hate it. They've promised to cut the tongue out of anybody who utters the name Daesh or calls them Daesh, and therefore I'm calling them Daesh. You guys can call them whatever you want, but that's why I'm calling them Daesh. Anyway, Jared, what was their response to the anonymous threat?
There wasn't really a unified response from Daesh, partially because this isn't the first time that Anonymous has vowed to wage war against the group. You'll recall that immediately following the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris back in January, Anonymous and hackers claiming to be affiliated with Anonymous conducted very similar attacks to disrupt Daesh-related social media accounts and websites. My sense is that Daesh probably has a little bit more to focus on right now, considering that French and Russian jets are currently pounding strategic locations throughout Syria. So the fact that you haven't really heard anything from Daesh, I wouldn't read into that too much.
Okay. Jared, in terms of the success of the previous campaign, it does seem as though they've been playing whack-a-mole a bit. Twitter shuts down accounts, more pop up. I mean, at what point can what firm steps can be taken to actually shutting this down?
You know, that's sort of the biggest question with regarding any sort of anonymous campaign, especially because, as we've seen in the past, often anonymous efforts to take down undesirable organizations, their recent promise to unmask members of the KKK in the United States have been uneven and, as you said, sort of the equivalent of whack-a-mole. You know, the ostensibly the idea is to disrupt the very digital space where ISIS, Daesh, does a significant amount of their recruiting. They are by far the most sophisticated terrorist organization on the planet with regards to how they try to recruit and radicalize potential militants in Western countries. So it's not – time will tell exactly how efficient it is. You know, we're in the early stages of Anonymous's kind of cyber assault on the group, and it's really a question of how long that assault will last.
One would hope, I would hope, that various intelligence organizations, trolls, you know, activists and others have set up fake Daesh accounts on Twitter. And so one of the things I like about this taking down of real Daesh-related Twitter accounts is that it alters the balance between the real ones and the fake ones. We want people who are actually looking to be recruited or looking to be persuaded by this organization to actually be interacting with anti-Daesh people as opposed to pro-Daesh people. That would make the world a slightly better place. Now, Anonymous is not the only group that's going after them on social media. There's also an organization called the Ghost Security Group. What is the Ghost Security Group, Jared, and what are they doing?
So Ghost Security builds itself as sort of a crowdsourced counterterrorism volunteer group. The best reporting on them right now is by Will Turk, who's a very young, brilliant reporter at the Daily Dot, who's forged inroads with all these higher collectives. He really knows them inside and out. But compared to Anonymous, Security has been a little bit more meticulous. Rather than just, as you said, playing whack-a-mole with these accounts, they'll gather information and infiltrate these accounts, and then through an intermediary, an intelligence analysis group, they'll actually feed this information to law enforcement officials. So it's kind of ironic. You see hacktivist groups and law enforcement officials who have traditionally not been the biggest fans of each other, actually collaborating and cooperating, even in the most peaceful of senses, in retribution, for this horrific attack on Paris.
It does seem as though this has really got Anonymous fired up, but they've been fired up before. How seriously do you think law enforcement are going to take this? And do you think there is going to be a proper working relationship between the two groups, or is it going to stay rather more informal?
I think a working relationship, I think that sort of sense of a relationship would be a stretch. I mean, Anonymous released a message earlier today that basically advised global governments to step aside and let them do their work. And, you know, it's as I mentioned, because of the unevenness of past Anonymous campaigns, it's difficult to buy into this and say, oh, well, we should step aside and like let these hacktivists take a role. But I think the relationship between Ghost Security on spin, though it's still a very most remarkable technological goal to contemporary counterterrorism efforts. And, I think working relationships.
We're having some, I'm sorry, Jared, we're having some Skype issues, just as it appeared we would have when we started the show. Sometimes Skype is with us and sometimes it's against us. But before I let you go, I just wanted to make the point that it's one of the interesting things about the Paris attacks is that it comes after a quick succession of other attacks that have essentially united the world in a very big way against Daesh. The Russians are now admitting that the airliner that crashed was blown out of the sky by a bomb, and Daesh is taking responsibility for that. A couple of days before the Paris bombings, they attacked Beirut. Of course, they consider all Shiite Muslims to be apostates, and so Iran and other Shiite governments and people are going after them. The United States, which had been bombing in a specific type of way, has stepped it up. And one of the things that's happening is the U.S. is now taking out all the oil and gasoline that's being transported within Iraq, which is a source of revenue. So and those are just a few examples, but everybody's turning up their anti-Daesh activities to 11 now. And so it's going to be super, super difficult for them increasingly. And they've made the strategic error of thinking that they don't need allies because they have none. And they've united the world against them. So it's I think that things are going to get very, very difficult for them, and I'm very happy to see it. Jared Keller is at Maxim.com, and you can find him on Twitter at Jared B. Keller. Jared, if you can still talk through Skype, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you again for having me, and have a lovely day.
All right. We got some more news coming right up, but first I want to talk about the perfect holiday gift, Ring Video Doorbell, one of our sponsors today. I want you to give all of your loved ones, except little kids who don't own doors, the Ring Video Doorbell, because it's such a great gift. Now, if you may be hesitating to give something, now you've heard about the Ring Video Doorbell, right? It's a little box that replaces your old and busted doorbell with the new hotness. If people push the button, it rings the bell, not only in your house, but on your phone, and then you get live video plus audio communication with who's ever at the door. So you can sit there and talk to them, whether you're in your living room or you're in China. It doesn't matter. As long as you have an internet connection, you can have an interactive conversation and you see them. They can't see you, but you can see them. And it will also, if you set it up to do this, it will detect motion. And when anything moves in front of your front door, it'll record video and store it in the cloud and you can review it later. I've got thousands of videos that have been recorded. It's in the cloud. It doesn't bother me at all. Whenever I want to go back and look at videos, I can check it out. They're high quality, high resolution videos with a very, very wide angle lens. I can see one side of the house, the other side of the house, and everything in between. And it's so great. But I want you to give this as a gift, because if you're concerned about something that has to be mounted, essentially installed on a house, if you're concerned about giving that as a gift because you think you're burdening somebody with a difficult project or something that will have to send them off to the hardware store to get additional materials, I want to ease your mind about that, because the Ring Video Doorbell comes with everything you need to install it. And the installation is super easy. I am not good at all about installing things. I'm not a handyman type of guy. This was trivially easy to install. It comes with a drill, a screwdriver, a little level. It's important that it's level, because when you see the video, you want the video to be level. It comes with absolutely everything you need. It's like an entire little toolbox custom for the Ring Video Doorbell. So when you give this gift, you're not only giving the gift of security, you're giving the gift of total information awareness, which is I'm co-opting that term because the NSA gave up on it a few years ago. Total information awareness about what's going on at your front door. You're also giving the gift of a screwdriver, a drill, a level, a charger for charging it. You barely have to charge, like, you know, charge it once a year or whatever. Yeah, it's like the battery never dies. And it's just a great gift. It's the perfect gift, and people will be thrilled to have it. It's a wonderful, wonderful gift, and I really love mine. I just wish I had more doors in the house, and I'd buy more, because, of course, a cloud site will support any number of Ring Video Doorbells. So highly recommended for yourself and highly recommended as a gift this year. Give the gift of peace of mind. Give the gift of convenience with the Video Doorbell. Time magazine named one of their top 10 gadgets. Go to ring.com/TNT for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/TNT. And with Ring, you're always home. Well, a new watch from Movado and HP has no screen. It's an analog watch called the Bold Motion, but it's still a smartwatch. Sean O'Kane is a reporter for The Verge and joins us to explain what's going on with this watch. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. What makes the Movado Bold Motion a smartwatch?
So the Movado Bold Motion is actually part of a program that HP started last year called Engineered by HP. And it basically is a way for them to sort of dip their toe into the smartwatch market without making a do-or-die kind of smartwatch that they need to sell thousands or millions of units of. And what they do is they basically have been looking for different traditional watchmakers who are also trying to get into the smartwatch game and partnering with them by putting some very limited smarts inside what is considered to be a traditional analog watch. That way you sort of get some of the benefits like step counting and some notification alerts without giving away the sort of analog style that these companies are known for, and also without removing the sort of timelessness. A lot of people like to buy these or watches from these companies because they like to keep them for a long time. So the theory behind this is, you know, even if HP's smarts eventually die, you're going to have a Movado watch that still looks good and still works in 10, 15 years.
Case of HP actually going out and just sticking their toe in the market and not being very serious about it. I mean, if you remember what they were doing with, you know, the Palm OS, with tablets, they sort of dabbled in it and then withdrew. Is this a serious play by HP, or are they just mucking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely right to think of it that way. It's in a lot of ways, I think HP is doing what Intel spent a couple years doing, where it's sort of spinning its wheels, getting into some platforms that it doesn't know whether it wants to stay in. But I mean, at least in the near term, they're committed to this. You know, they already have a couple other companies lined up for this program that they've already built some stuff out for, and they just won't say who yet. So, you know, at least over the next year or two, this is the direction they want to go. And it's a direction they're going to be able to make some money off of. I mean, these traditional watch companies are trying sort of every year to figure out how to get a piece of this growing smartwatch market. And that's why we see a couple weeks ago, Tag Heuer announced their first smartwatch, although that had a full screen, it's basically an Android Wear watch. And Fossil spent almost $300 million buying Misfit, which is another sort of smart wearables company. So at least in the short term, HP is going to be able to make some money off of these partnerships. And they're also selling them through their own distribution channels. So whether or not they stick around this in the long term is probably right to question.
I would have loved to have been in the room when they talked about the Misfit acquisition. Gosh, do you think Misfit is a good fit, or is Misfit a misfit? Anyway, that would have been good comedy. And congratulations, Sean, on your pronunciation of Tag Heuer. Very well done.
It's taken me the entire 2 weeks since that event to really finally.
That's how long it takes.
It's still tough.
That's how long it takes. So this whole idea of flashing lights as a communications medium, in this case, there's a bit of a learning curve. This color light means this, that flash means that. This has been tried by other wearable computing devices. And in fact, it's a whole category of interface that actually, the original PC had a flashing light interface as well, but that's another story. Things like Google Glass-like devices have been able to minimize the electronics and create glasses that look just like regular glasses by using just flashing lights for notifications. Do you think the public is willing to learn what these flashing lights means? Is this a non-starter just because people won't, or do you think that people are willing to do that?
I don't think it's going to sell people on the device. I think it's going to make people who are hesitant to really embrace the idea of a smartwatch, but also still want something that looks like a classic Movado watch, be okay with what they're getting. Some of the ideas are kind of clever. The one particular one that jumped out at me is to relay that you have a meeting coming up. It'll blink the remaining LEDs around the circle between the time now and the time your meeting is. And that at least has some cleverness to it. The other ones, you know, like filling up around the ring to show how much battery it has or how close you are to your step counting goals. You know, those ones are kind of, I don't know what I'm getting out of those. And the big problem that I see with it as someone who wears an actual smartwatch every day is I don't see where the value comes in. If I get a buzz on my wrist and I can tell what kind of notification it is, I guess that's sort of helpful, but I'm still going to have to dig in my pocket to know whether or not I need to interact with that. Whereas with a smartwatch that shows me that notification and lets me read through it a bit, even if I can't take action on it, I know if it's something I need to deal with right now. And you know, for someone in a job where I need to be monitoring those notifications all the time, that means the world to me. For people who are also dipping their toe into the smartwatch market like HP is, you know, maybe this is all they need. Maybe this is sort of their gateway and the transition from buying traditional watches to buying something that's closer to a smartwatch. I mean, this is really still for people who have $700 to throw away on a watch. So.
But it's interesting, Sean, that you mentioned, you know, your own experience with the smartwatch. I sometimes worry whether we in the tech field are in a bit of a bubble about this, because it seems still a very niche product, something that techies with a fair amount of money are willing to, you know, are willing to buy, but not much evidence that the general public is getting behind it. Have you seen much evidence of wider uptake on these things?
No, I mean, that's totally legitimate. I hear people all the time wonder, even here, some of my coworkers wonder why we need a smartwatch. For me, I was sold on it the moment I've only ever owned a Pebble, but the moment I put it on my wrist, I found value in it. But I understand the hesitance, and I understand why some people don't understand why, or might not need notifications served up to a different part of their body. But I think the ideas starting to make some headway. And I just don't know if a device like the Bold Motion is actually going to bridge that gap. I don't really love the design of it, but the first thing that HP did in this program, the Chrono Wing watch that they made with Michael Bastian last year, makes a little more sense, because it actually has a bit of a screen underneath the sort of analog bits, and it can tell you at least what kinds of notifications are. You have two messages waiting, or you have three emails that are new. And I think something that at least isn't as codified is probably going to get more people interested in the idea of a smartwatch than something that's so, this is just a little too opaque, that it's really just an analog watch with some lights, and it can kind of tell you some things that you wouldn't have gotten from a traditional watch.
I think that in general, in principle, engineered by HP is a great idea, because essentially the economics of wristwatches are that, you know, people pick one that isn't going to have mass adoption. I mean, if you go to a jewelry store or wherever it is you're going to buy a traditional watch, you know, you're not going to buy a watch that millions of other people have. It's not going to happen. That's not how the segment works. They have huge markups, and you try to find a watch that's kind of unique, you know, relatively unique. That's completely different from, say, the Apple Watch, where they're trying to sell millions of identical watches.
Yeah.
That are different only in terms of the materials, the band, and all that kind of stuff. And so this engineered by HP idea, I think in theory, I don't know that HP can pull it off, would have them putting their technology into many dozens of different types of watches. And so people could buy watches as they did traditionally, and HP would have a kind of scale behind the scenes, whereas the watchmakers would have some reason to sell traditional watches in the smartwatch era. And I think that theoretically makes sense. I'm not so sure it's going to work in reality, but in theory, I think that's a pretty good idea. Now, this watch is water resistant at 50 meters, as you mentioned, at $695. There's a stainless steel finish one and an all black finish stainless steel model. And we'll see how it sells. Sean O'Kane, I want to thank you for coming on the show. Sean O'Kane is at TheVerge.com and on Twitter at SOKane1. Sean, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Mike.
Google announced yesterday that Google Search has recently gotten a lot smarter. The search engine can understand superlatives, dates, and multifaceted questions more easily. For example, Google says natural language queries like, what are the largest cities in Texas? Or, what was the population of Singapore in 1965? And, who was the U.S. president when the Angels won the World Series? These will all result in accurate results, apparently. Ian, I think this is a great benefit here. You know, I'm still really old-fashioned in my searches. I do Boolean searches still, and I probably need to start just asking questions.
I don't know. I've been using Boolean searches pretty much as soon as they implemented them, and I'm not about to give them up now. But it does seem like Google is making some real advances in machine learning when it comes to their search. I think that's what's driving this. The company has plowed billions into AI research to deal with just this sort of problem. But the knock-on effects to other industries are going to be huge, because if they can apply this to search, they can apply it to a whole host of other jobs, if it works, and really sort of use software to, well, apart from putting a lot of people out of work, to actually make an awful lot of things more efficient. I think new capabilities are very, very handy, and they're going to help a lot of people who, you know, the very idea of putting and or not into a search has never even occurred to them. But from Google's perspective, anything that gets more people searching for more information just means more money for them.
Yeah, it absolutely is, and you know, it also facilitates spoken language searches or virtual assistant. You ultimately just want to ask HAL 9000, you know, what's the answer to this question, and have it the answer come back. That's what they're getting at. Well, I think we're a long way from that, but this is a big step in that direction because, of course, if it can understand and tease out the actual meaning of what you're saying rather than just responding blindly to different combinations of words, then you're on your way to be able to interact with this thing like it's a virtual person. All right, well, another product. I'm sorry, you had another comment?
Oh, no, I was going to say on the voice thing, you're absolutely right. I was back in the UK visiting my relatives, and my parents were astounded by voice search on Google, just saying, OK, Google, and then asking a question. My mum was like, it's like something out of Star Trek. And immediately they were just like, how can I get this on my phone? And unfortunately, the phones they're using are a little dumb and weren't able to do it. But I think voice plus machine intelligence is going to make a huge difference. So,
it will, and it absolutely is out of Star Trek. Star Trek really nailed that one. Just talk to the computer. Computer talks back. It can understand when it's being spoken to, when it isn't. It can understand the context and so on, and that is where we're going. And that's a perfect interface because, of course, that's the one most natural to human beings. So that is the right interface. All right, in product update news, Google Glass may ship without a screen. At least one version of Glass may omit the screen, according to an exclusive on The Information website. The headset will communicate with the user via voice and sound. This is they're suggesting in the article that this would be for fitness. Other versions, possibly two other versions, would keep the screen, as we saw in the prototype version. Ian Thompson, I actually recommended that they come out with a version of Google Glass with no camera, because I think the camera, although it's nice to have a camera, in fact, most users used it almost entirely as a hands-free camera. That's the thing that freaked everybody out and gave Google Glass such a bad reputation that was seen as a privacy-invading device above all. But in fact, the use of Google Glass to get information, to see screens invisibly, to be able to interact with the internet and social media and messaging hands-free was very, very powerful. So I'd love to see a camera-free version. But do you think... what do you think the future of Google Glass is going to be, Ian? I mean, is this going to actually be able to break through its bad reputation and become a viable consumer product, or is this destined for the periphery?
Well, I think you're right on the camera. You have to have a camera with Glass, but one thing they could have done is just put a physical hardware cover over it so you could reassure people that you're not monitoring the whole time. I think Google is still committed to Glass. They're still pumping a lot of money into it. And I think they're going to come up with some interesting designs. They've just partnered up with Luxottica, which owns about 80% of the luxury eyewear market, to develop new form factors. I mean, the original Google Glass was an engineering project, and it showed very much, you know, engineers didn't get the psychology of how this was going to freak people out. And I think now they've learned their lesson. They've even started using the term glass holes themselves. They used to complain to us bitterly about using that term. But the original series was mishandled. I think if they really put their money into it and they put some decent design into it, they could make it work. And in particular, the bone conductivity thing sounds like a very good idea. It would take an awful lot of the hassle out of wearing earplugs and that sort of thing. And it's a good way of transmitting sound.
It's exactly silently with nothing in your ears, and I actually like that feature as well. You know, a lot of people still disparage Google Glass, and I wish people would stop doing it. And here's why: I have a Google Alert set up. If you don't use Google Alerts, you should. It's a fantastic way to have preemptive searching, and when the result hits the internet, it comes to you via email. I have a search for Google Glass for the scientific version of alerts. I think it's called Science Alerts or something like that. There are two versions of Google Alerts. And the amount of research that's taking place using Google Glass as the hardware platform is astounding, and a lot of brilliant things. Applications for the blind, applications for you know, all kinds of people in different areas of work. Hands-free computer interfaces are few and far between, and they're needed out there. And the scientific research that's taking place with Google Glass is super, super important and very, very impressive. And whether it actually ever becomes a standard thing that consumers actually use is almost irrelevant. There are so many people who can get huge amounts of benefit from a hands-free, on-your-face computer camera / whatever that I think we all need to realize that this is a very worthwhile project.
Yeah, but in particularly, what I'm waiting for is the augmented reality version, because that really would have some huge benefits. If you could actually put the pair of these glasses on and just have stuff popping up in view but still being able to see around you, it would take an awful lot of the sting out of it, I think. And you're right, in terms of the applications for something like this are massive, and it is going to come. The question is whether Google can make it work or whether someone's going to take the work that Google's put in and actually put it into a form factor and a design that people like and are willing to pay for, and they're going to take it on. I think, honestly, Google wouldn't be too upset if somebody did that, but obviously they'd like to own it themselves, but I think they just think it's more important that this stuff gets out. This is a huge passion of Sergey Brin's, and he's desperate to see something on the market soon.
Yeah, and a couple of things I want to talk about before we move on from this topic. One of them is that Google is working behind the scenes with Luxottica, which is the world's largest eyewear company. They are best known for their sub-brands, which include Ray-Ban, Oakley, and also the luxury brands like Chanel, Prada, Giorgio Armani, Burberry, Versace, Dolce & Gabbana. I think I'm saying that right. I don't know how to say fashion brands. But, you know, almost all the glasses that you get in the United States anyway are essentially Luxottica brands. And Google has been working with them behind the scenes for consumer, both prescription and sunglasses and non-prescription glasses, or so we should assume based on various comments people have said. Now, you also mentioned augmented reality. I want to talk a little bit about nomenclature again, because there's so many words flying around for things that go on your face where you experience information in a new way. So one of them is virtual reality. Virtual reality is when you are completely immersed and you only see the virtual space, artificially created, computer-generated objects, characters, etc., even if it's in real time. Okay. Another term that is pretty new but hasn't really caught on is mixed reality. And this is where you see the real world and you also see things that are not there. That's also called insanity or hallucination. But if it's augmented by electronics, then it's mixed reality. Now, you mentioned augmented reality. For a long time, mixed reality was called augmented reality. But actually, the kind of augmented reality you're talking about is kind of been forgotten with all the goggles out there. And this is the kind that Google Glass would really excel at. You're looking at somebody and it's like, oh, that's Steve Smith you're looking at. And that's augmented reality, where you basically get information or labels or, you know, contextual information that's based on what you're looking at in the real world. That kind of augmented reality is brilliant for eyeglasses, because you want to walk around and just have knowledge about things. There are also applications for people who may be suffering from some level of dementia to help them remember people and things and places and all that kind of stuff. By the way, they're remaking Memento. So I don't know if that's a good idea, but that remake is coming. I think the original was probably perfect. But anyway, there are a lot of applications for augmented reality. So let's make sure we'll try to do on this show, get all the words right. But let's bring back good old fashioned augmented reality.
Well, yes. I mean, it would be tremendously useful if someone with a poor memory like myself would dearly love to sort of, every time you go to a conference or a gathering of people that you should know and people that you've met a couple of times in the past, they're like, oh, how are you? Great to see you again. And there's that thing in the back of your head just like, lovely to see you. Who on earth are you? And if you could just have something which would, you know, little bone conductor on the back of the head just going, this is Tony Smith, you met him 3 weeks ago at such and such an event. Could be tremendously useful, not just for people who've got illnesses, but also just in terms of keeping people informed. It's going to change social interaction, certainly, because once that happens, people are going to become aware that you're being fed information about them, and that's going to alter the dynamic of how you converse. And then coming back to what you were saying about Luxottica, I think that's a really interesting move, because Google doesn't do style very well. Very good on engineering, not very good on style, whereas Luxottica has basically built a multi-billion-dollar industry out of selling us a couple of pieces of glass surrounded by plastic with a brand name on it, which we are willing to pay large amounts of money to buy. So I think partnering with them is a very smart move. But in terms of how this is going forward, it's coming. It's going to come. There are too many uses not to have something like this.
Absolutely. And by the way, I still have my prototype version of Google Glass, and I still enjoy it mostly as a camera, I'm ashamed to say, but it is a great camera. All right, well, we got some more news coming right up, but first I want to talk about Boll & Branch, our other sponsor today. You spend so much time in bed between the sheets, make them good sheets. Boll & Branch will make it affordable, and they'll give you great, great sheets. This is a great company, and one of the things I love about this company is that their sheets are entirely made from organic cotton. People don't think about all the pesticides and stuff that is put in a cotton, but organic cotton is a wonderful thing. And they are also certified fair trade, and that is a great thing as well. That should help you sleep even better than these awesome sheets would normally. Now, if you go to, you can buy great sheets out there, and you will pay a fortune for them. Sometimes the department store markups are 800% or up to 800%. I mean, it's just enormous, the markups on these things. With Boll & Branch, they cut out the middleman and sell you these sheets at a really, really great value. And I'm going to tell you in just a minute how you can make that an even better value. But, you know, they have all kinds of great colors and materials. These are really great sheets. If you really want a great night's sleep, you need certain things. You need a dark room. You need a good mattress. You need a great pillow. And you need great sheets. And Boll & Branch will take care of the sheets for you. Boll & Branch is so confident you'll love their sheets that they'll let you try them for 30 nights. Gets even better. If you order right now, they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. Go to BollandBranch.com and use the offer code TNT. Make sure you use the offer code TNT. $50 off a set of sheets immediately by going to BollandBranch.com and use the offer code TNT. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Well, the news you can use, Asus and Google are now selling their Chromebit dongle, which turns any screen that has an HDMI port into a Chrome OS computer. Reviewers say the price is right, but performance is slow. The device comes with just 2 gigabytes of RAM and can't handle lots of tabs or high-resolution video. Still, Ian, I think this is a cool product. I want one because it's so cheap for the same reason you want a Chromecast. It's just cheap, carried around in your pocket. You'll always have access to essentially a Chromebook, albeit a slow one.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I looked at this and thought, oh, yes, they've done Chromecast for Acer. I mean, it's a very nice idea, and it's going to be a good way to get Chrome OS out there a bit more. My only caveat towards this is I'm not sure there are that many people who want to carry it around with them. I think it's something you're probably going to stick on a living room smart TV, use it that way. Chrome has also got a slight problem with developer support. There aren't enough good apps out there to use the system. So I think it's certainly going to be very useful, and at that price point, very cheap to, you know, install an extra computer onto your system. But it depends what you want to use it for. You know, if you're just using it for streaming video, then why bother spending the extra money and just go for a Chromecast? But if you actually want to use this as a serious second computer, maybe something for the kids, it could be something worth looking into.
And Google is sort of leaning toward pitching it for kiosks, for experiential marketing, things like that. And I think one of the reasons for that is you think, oh, wow, I just carry this thing. I can carry it in my pocket all the time. And whenever I run across a big TV that I want to use as a computer, I'll just plug this in. No, that's not going to work because you need a keyboard and you probably want a mouse as well. And so you're already carrying a keyboard and mouse. You might as well carry a tablet or, you know, a real computer or something with better performance. So this isn't for the masses. This isn't even for the number of people who would use a Chromecast. I think this is for business travelers who may want to just walk into a conference room where there's already a Bluetooth keyboard there or something like that, plug in, or maybe they're in a hotel, they want to use the hotel TV or whatever. Buy carefully, despite the low price. You still need that keyboard and consider where you would use this before you get it. But I'm a big fan of Chrome OS, but this is an interesting new product. Of course, we heard about this back and reported it to you back in March, so this is finally here. All right, well, a TNT fan of the day is Michael Carney, who posted this picture on Instagram. Yeah, he watches Tech News Today on his iPhone and says he doesn't need an Apple Watch. He just lashes the iPhone to his wrist with a rubber band. Which, by the way, the rubber band is much cheaper than an Apple Watch, I hasten to point out. All right, show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture or do some stunt like this. And post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. And please use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Ian Thompson, thank you so much for co-anchoring today. It was great to see you co-anchoring. You're a new Tuesday co-anchor. Can you talk a little bit about what you do at the Register, what your beat is, the sorts of things that you write? And by the way, you're based in San Francisco, right?
Yeah. I came out here for a year's posting 7 years ago and haven't really left. It's a marvelous place to be. I mean, here at the Register, we're sort of taking a slightly snarky look, but at the same time, in terms of look at where we're going. And my personal beat, security and software, basically. So I'm covering a lot of Google, an awful lot of Microsoft, sometimes a bit too much Microsoft, but hey, if they are going to make the bad news, then we're here to report it. So, yeah, I mean, as I say, in terms of the areas that we're covering, it's really a large scale of enterprise stuff, some consumer stuff, a little bit of science maybe at the weekends. But we're really sort of trying to take a serious look at the technology, but with a slightly snarky overtone. But we do love our headlines, I'll give it that.
Yes, I do too. And I love the snarky overtone. I love the fact that you have these hilarious labels for companies and you just stick with it. For example, the Register refers to Google as the chocolate factory, et cetera. So.
Yes, well, I mean, that's. I actually had a bit of a run-in with one of Google's PRs. Because they're saying, is there any way you could stop referring to us as the chocolate factory? That would be the PR coup of the decade. And I had to explain to her that it's actually a compliment.
Yeah.
We call them the chocolate factory because of Willy Wonka, the chocolate factory, obviously. But she was like, but that's the weirdo who stalks around. Like, no, read the books. There are two books by Roald Dahl. And it's actually a compliment if you look at the book. I blame the youth of today. They're just raised on film and cinema. If you actually read the books, it's a compliment. But it's the reason we've done that is partly because we like poking fun, but mainly because we write about these companies a lot. And if you're writing in a sentence, Google's done this, Google's done that, particularly when you're writing about something like Google Glass, you can't have too many Googles in a sentence. So it makes sense to actually sort of give them a name. The readers love it as well, with Chipzilla, with Intel, Cook & Co. for Apple. It adds a bit more fun. I do think that, when it comes to tech news, we can't be too po-faced about these things, which is in the way Twitter's raison d'etre as well.
Absolutely. And I love it. I love your snark and the way you guys write. It makes it just a lot of fun. Ian Thompson, I want to thank you for calling in today, and we will see you next week.
Okay,
maybe will we see you next week?
Sadly, I have family commitments.
Right,
but I'll be back in 3 weeks' time.
Wonderful. We'll see you in 3 weeks. Thanks, Ian.
Cheers, Mike.
Bye bye. Let us know what's on your mind. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. That's 260-868-7469. You can subscribe to Tech News Today from your favorite podcast app. You can also check us out at twit.tv/TNT for other subscription options. You can watch us live, of course, every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv/live. And we invite you to subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. You can follow me personally at elgin.com. Don't miss our other news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. The show is produced by Jason Kleanthis and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.